You don't realize how much you say until you're on a microphone. Yeah. So today I want to talk about the age of resurrection and art, and specifically poetry in the age of resurrection. Last week, and I want to say, I have an idea personally of like a theology of creativity. I wrote creation, but I really should. It's theology of creativity, is what I mean. And but I don't have it in my own mind settled. And I think of it as something that, you know, we're doing together as a part of this class, is exploring how we partner with God in creativity. And that's, you know, last week we just discussed and looked at the first several chapters of Genesis and how, and his response to sin is creativity. He continues to create, whether it's making clothes for the man and the woman, or creating a mark to protect Cain. And that God seeks creative collaborators, like the man and the woman in the garden, like Noah in building the ark, and ultimately like Abram and Israel in the church. But of course, this red line is representative of the timeline. If you're going to talk about the age of resurrection, I think that you have to talk about the age of death first. And, you know, there are a lot of things in those early chapters of Genesis that are, I think, maybe challenging ethically or morally. And I've kind of asked, just save those for someone else. And we accept that something happened that was bad. We accept, we give God the benefit of the doubt on things like the flood. But we know that whether death is like some force that was just waiting outside for the man and the woman to eat of the fruit and rush in, you know, I'm here now, or, you know, how that worked, I don't know. But I know that there is suffering in the world, and I know that there is death, and that for a very, very long time, it seems that death and the instruments of death were the only option. And with that in mind, I thought we would just start off with this poem by Billy Collins titled Scenes of Hell. And let me see. So, this is my third time doing this. I know that people who are here like to have a paper copy, but don't forget, if there's someone on Zoom, they like to see the text too, not just hear me read it. So if I did this correctly, this QR code, if you want to see the poem as it looks, this will pull up a PDF, and you can see the poem as it looks on paper. And I also have the text. Is that working? Okay, no promises that it works, but you know. Oh, excellent. So, but I also have it printed out as well on the slides. So, Scenes of Hell by Billy Collins. We did not have the benefit of a guide, no crone to lead us off the common path, no ancient to point the way with a staff. But there were bad lands to cross, rivers of fire and blackened peaks, and eventually we looked down and see. The jeweler running around the gold ring, the boss trapped in an hourglass, the baker buried up to his eyes in flour, the baker plummeting in a coin, the teacher disappearing into a blackboard, and the grocer silent under a pyramid of vegetables. We saw the pilot nosediving and the whore impaled on a bedpost, the pharmacist wandering in a stupor, and the child with toy wheels for legs. You pointed to the soldier who was dancing with his empty uniform, and I remarked on the blind tourist. But what truly caught our attention was the scene in the long mirror of ice. You lighting the wick on your head, me blowing on the final spark, and our children trying to crawl away from their eggshells. So I'm just interested in your responses to this poem. And in my mind, if it works out, I do have a point when it's all at the end of class why we're looking at this now. But let's just explore this poem. What stands out to you or strikes you?
Sadness.
Sadness. Thought of the Christmas Carol with, was it a ghost or?
Marley.
Marley's ghost had chains and a coin box.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Kevin?
For whatever reason, it almost felt dream-like to me, which then reminded me of Dante and his Divine Comedy, which starts off in that dark wood entering into hell and seeing those scenes.
Yeah, it's a God's eye perspective over this scene. Yes, Jen.
If it weren't for the verbs in each phrase, the nouns would go together in a very normal way.
Can you give me an example?
So
if it weren't for the verbs in the phrase, the nouns would go together in a way that doesn't seem sad or scary. Or so they're normal. Jeweler, rings.
Okay.
Boss, yes. Hours. Bakers, flour. Bankers, coin. Teachers, blackboard. Like, that's all fine and normal.
Yeah.
And then you put the verbs in there, and it totally changes.
Yeah. Classic Russian.
He's working without a net.
Okay.
Yeah, first a comment. I love Billy Collins because I've never had to use a dictionary.
Yes.
And I can't say that about many poets.
Right.
He doesn't try and dazzle me with great phrases, and that they're all simple. And for that reason may come forth truer for me. I've got a couple reactions. Is one, it feels overall very sad to me. And two, the last paragraph seems so much like the ending of a relationship and not such a global thing that may actually affect everything that's said before it. In the poet's communicate. That's what he seems to be bringing me to this point, and this is what framed it. The other is that it's a hopeful poem for me in a perverse way, because it says that there are no guides, and with that I can't depend upon anyone else, that I have to look inside, and that any meaning and any strength is all contained within. That's not something somebody else can give to you.
No. Well, that's interesting. I always come to this poem when I'm feeling very negative and hopeless. So I mean, that's a great perspective and something that I think we should weigh. Thank you for those comments. I'm curious, Jen, if, like, I was bothered by the use of this word whore. I mean, all of these other people, I mean, with, you could still say whore bedpost, and I wouldn't like it. And it bothered, like, these other terms are people, worker. You know, like, you could use the term sex worker or prostitute even, and I would feel like it's a more human term. And that line really bothered me. This was, I think, 2008. It's from a collection called Ballistics.
That has changed that, because yeah. I assumed it was older, mm-hmm. and that would have just been the word for a prostitute.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Because now it bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I also thought of these, you know, I think of these people, the jeweler, the baker, even the boss, as almost like old-time terms. Like, you know, the grocer, you know, I don't really think of the people in the grocery store today as grocers and the baker. I mean, it's like almost, you know, artisanal language back when, you know, you had to be an apprentice for these things. And so... and of course, Pilate is maybe a little more modern, more contemporary than what I'm thinking with these other terms. Let me get Brian. Seth, can we get Brian? And then let's go with Dan. I was thinking the same thing.
To my comment, Billy does not, you don't need a dictionary for whore. There's nothing sophisticated about it. It's very black, it's very white. And we may not like the nature of the work, but I may not like the work or the nature of a banker either. Mm-hmm. And so where do I put myself into the poem? Or into the verse.
And I really mean not, although I would have, I don't even want to say judgment, I don't want someone to have to do that type of work, to be forced into it. I think the term is, it's just very dehumanizing in my eyes, without a dictionary.
Yeah. Destruction. It's
fucking them down.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's dehumanizing all of them. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, four makes sense.
Okay. Well, Brian.
Dan's first comment gave me the word I was trying to encapsulate. The whole thing was, you know, poetic until the last stanza. And as Linda just pointed out to me, that's the only stanza that has more than one person. Your head.
Well, I mean, it starts off with we, and then it moves. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it does. It starts out with
you,
we.
To you and I.
And that was a gut punch for me because I realized, you know, with all the things surrounding me in my circumstances right now, friends, children, that this isn't so much death, this is death of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything that tugs at my heart, it's breaking relationship. Mm-hmm. And it gave weight to the earlier stanzas. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Who is that? Oh, Wendy. Wendy is. Oh. I don't know. Maybe my presentation wasn't so good.
Are we on? Oh, I'm sorry about that. This poem to me from the very beginning, I mean the title, tells you that this is hell on earth, is what this is. And it all seems to be leading to that last stanza. And I cannot stand the image of someone lighting their last wick and the person that's supposed to love them blowing it out. Mm-hmm. And the kids trying to escape it all. Mm. That is just too sad.
Yeah.
The phrase that jumps out to me is actually not in this poem, but in our weekly prayer, our complicity in the struggles of this world, right? It starts off, you feel like a God's eye view, but it's not God viewing this. It's us, and we're involved in it as well, as we see in our reflection. So...
I think as I read back through it and as we talk about it, that I feel similar kind of to what Dan was saying. And the opposite of what Wendy was saying is that the last line to me is the hopeful line. Because the children are trying to crawl away from their eggshells, that boundary that kept them in.
Yes.
That trap, that shell that they were trapped in. Yeah. And they're crawling away from that trap. And they're no longer trapped in all of this.
Well, I think.
I think that comes to like what you were saying about when you're in a bad place that you come to poetry like this. And I think that's similar. Like I've talked about, like when I'm in a bad place, I don't want to listen to happy music. I listen to Nine Inch Nails and like because that is where you need. Because if I listen to happy music, it's just going to piss me off.
Yeah.
And so I need something that is as down as I am, but has that little spark of hope. And I think, to me, I see that line as that, like the rest of it is down.
Yeah.
And that last piece is like, they could get out.
So my take on that last stanza was that it's a description of childhood trauma. That it's not so much escaping and an egg like hatching, but like a field of eggshells they've had to live on their whole lives because their parents are always in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, just squeeze your hope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I came in to this space agreeing with you, but I'm Dan and everyone who else has followed in his reading is starting to sway me a little bit. But let's move on, and I'll see if this doesn't betray me. So, you know, we've had an age of death, and I think of the age of the death, of age of death as a monkey with a gun. And Ty sent me this like years ago, and I saved it because and throughout the pandemic, I would just have days where I was just like, yeah, this is a monkey with a gun type of day. And if the NRA has told us anything, the only thing that stops a primate with a gun... is a Christ event. So Jesus comes to earth. In his life, death, and resurrection, he inaugurates the kingdom of God. He comes and he reminds us what it's like to image God in creation. And we have the beginning of the age of resurrection. And Kevin, he shared something with me that he had read about how someone had said, it's like, you know, the Christ event is like D-Day in World War II. The Allies come in and they win that battle, and there's still a war. But mostly the Nazis are in retreat, and we know how it's going to end. And eventually there's V-Day. So eventually Christ will return, I believe, and complete the work he started in his life, death, and resurrection. The struggle is like, you know, we live in this age of overlapping ages. We live in this time of overlapping ages. And we have the hope that has been established in that Christ event. And we also get the weariness of the age of death and the doubt that comes with the age of death. And this age of resurrection, I think, is itself a creative process that as we strive to conform so that our lives match the life of Christ, God is using us as a creative collaborator. And so that is kind of the conclusion of my theology of creativity. And in that, I believe God is a creative being seeking creative collaborators. And presently, in this time of overlapping ages, that's us in this room. And that is true for people who paint or sculpt or write poetry. And in a few minutes, I think it's just true of people who read poetry. But it's also, we create when we gather. That there are many people who end up in the same place, but we intentionally come here with a creative mindset, and that I believe anyone who comes in here can get at least a little glimpse, however imperfect, of how things will be when Christ does return and fulfill the kingdom. Anyone can eat with us at our communion, our Lord's Supper. Anyone can share a name of someone they want to bring before God, and so on. And probably, I don't know, there might be some standards for the praise team, but they all sound so good. You would think that someone, I mean, with as many people that, anyway. But we create community. And I want, you know, one thing, in a couple of weeks anyway, you know, East County has a lot of things that churches have, like, you know, shepherds or a ministry stewardship group or deacons or what have you. And but one thing that's, I think, is really unique is East County has poets. And every other Thursday in the Lighthouse, there are people from this congregation who gather to write. And it's not necessarily, you know, spiritual or religious in nature, but more often than not, it's believers coming together to deal with the realities of creaturely existence. And as we live in hope most days. And I love being a part of that group, and you know, it's, I think of them in a lot of ways. I think often we are writing and reading for our congregation, similarly to the way that maybe our shepherds are praying for our congregation. I've never been a part of the shepherds praying, but I know that it happens, and to know that it happens on my behalf. And similarly, I think the poets of East County gather to strive for the new creation on behalf of this congregation. And anyone can come. All are welcome. So let's read another poem. And I'll leave this QR code up for a moment for anyone on Zoom. This is another one of my favorites, and this is a poem that actually became popular in 2013. It was called The Poem of the Year. So, Good Bones by Maggie Smith. I'm gonna need to get a drink. It's coffee. No, not Maggie Smith, the actress. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine. Oh, I'm going to need to, sorry about that. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. Any thoughts, responses?
This makes me think of the call for us to be image bearers in the world.
Thank you. I like this poem because I feel like it so encapsulates what it means to have hope while you still have one foot in the age of death. And this place is beautiful. There's so much beauty in it. There are so many wonderful birds and so many wonderful stones that can be thrown at them.
Thank you. I raised my hand, you said. I followed the rules. I got chills during this poem because, like you said, it is this combination of hope and dread. But the hope in me wants to believe that there's more than 50% good in the world. I loved it. I thought it was wonderful. And it could be absolutely, it could be my, I could have written that if I had the talent. It's very much what I believe.
And then no one.
It is interesting hearing this poem, living in a house, with people who struggle with severe depression. Although I live in a world where I work and I train and I teach and I understand depression, I don't struggle with depression. I live in a home with people who really do, and I feel like this poem is our narrative. This is this walking of both worlds. This is this where they both, I guess, kind of collide. And there was a time in my life when, as a trauma response, I became very Pollyanna to the extreme of I couldn't see reality. And I think as I have been forced to live in a very different reality that I cannot explain away or justify away or dream away or wish away. I appreciate the truth in this And to me, that's beautiful, that there's honesty here, and that there's truth, and that there is hope, and there is despair. And those two things can live side by side and be beautiful and have joy. It doesn't have to be an either or.
Thank you.
Yeah, I see these, I see this poem actually opposite, less hopeful than the first one. Because the first one is looking at it honestly. It's not hiding. This one says, well, if. But we're the children the author's trying to protect from the same observations that the narrators in the first one are making. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, but they're just being honest with you and looking at it in terms of relationship, right, and life. And this one is like, and that last line to me is not hopeful. It's like, this is the best you could do, and look what you've screwed up. Mm-hmm. You know, it is not, this is not a celebration. This is like, life sucks, deal with it. And this is the best we got. So, you know, it's not a despair, but it's not, I don't see this nearly even as hopeful as the previous poem, to me.
Well, I think we can all agree not to give you the microphone again. You know, one thing, in a couple of weeks, it's tone is so important. You know, it just in establishing tone and then weighing the options. You know, there's this poem, "The Road Not Taken" by Robert Frost. There's an entire book, like a 200-300 page book, about how we misread that because of Dead Poet Society. Because Robert Frost's tone is, yeah, he's like it doesn't make a difference anyway. But yeah, but thank you. That's okay.
It's okay, Nolan. I was expecting nothing less. Yeah. You know, there I have a lot of feelings and thoughts about this, but my biggest idea was that this was the poem of 2013 and how different it would be read in 2023. That was 10 years ago, and a lot of things have happened, and I think that that's where some of the struggle is for me, because I don't like conflict. I want things to be happy, but not fake happy. I want it to be real happy, and I think that there's been a change in how, I don't know, I was with a bunch of women yesterday sewing and just talking, and we were having the most like real conversation talking about like things that had never really been talked about, like in women's conversations, because we all just thought we were suffering alone. And the change and the juxtaposition of like, we can talk about the things that are really terrible and it not be all of how we feel or all of what we're dealing with, but it is a part of our daily conversation, and that's a shift. So I'm curious how this would be received today. Mm-hmm.
When I first came across this poem, I thought it had to have been, because I came across it maybe in the last year, and I thought, well, the reason I'm finding this now is because it just came out, but no, it was 10 years ago.
So even before Nolan made his comment, I had my hand to make a similar comment that I see this one as much as very unhopeful, and that the last line, the realtor, is just selling you a false bill of goods that you could make this place beautiful. It even says that. It's a real shithole, and they're just telling you that to try to sell you something that's not true. And therefore, that's why we do these 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. Because if it's gonna go down like that, let's enjoy it. So it may be terrible, but let's have fun on the way out.
Okay, yeah. You two definitely deserve each other.
So, Jen, you're saying eat, drink, and be merry, right? For tomorrow. Yeah. I think for me, just the first three words for me is the resolution of the whole thing, regarding life is short. Something that is really not talked about is death, especially in our culture, North America. And I'm being influenced by some readings I'm doing right now, but without the conversation of death, nothing really falls in place. For me, there's no meaning in life, because inevitably that's where I'm going. That's where we're all going. And so if you don't understand, for me, if I don't understand that, then of course I'm going to take a big bite out of the world, because nothing else matters. Or there's no meaning.
Something I feel about both of these poems is they don't really end in a resolution, right? The children are trying to crawl away. Who knows if they make it, right?
Right.
You could make this place beautiful. Mm-hmm. Is that going to happen? And I appreciate art, whether visual or musical or, you know, lyrical, that leaves this opening. Because then we get these different interpretations, right? And I think the point is that opening, not for us to discuss what the poem means, but it opens us to know ourselves more, our interpretations. Why are we interpreting it that way? What is it in our experience, in our perspective? I think that's the point of, you know, this activity of making art that creates these openings for us to identify ourselves and see ourselves.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the hand raising is becoming very menacing over here.
two responses to things that have been said is I think Nolan's point is that we all experience, poetry is about experience. It's not about what it means. It's but how I experience it, at least in the person who's receiving. And so that we each see each experience, and we can look at the same event, and we all see an entirely different, have an entirely different experience of it. So that's going to come out in the poetry. And so I don't think there's a right or a wrong, or he's got this point that, oh, maybe that's, that's what's ruined poetry for me, going up through the school system, is this is what this poem really means. Well, God, I must have been reading something entirely different. And, but in reading this poem or hearing this, listening to it, my experience was buying into this. The beginning of it was, yeah, I've been a screw up most of my life. I've taken the wrong choice. I've made the wrong choice pretty much in my life, through most of my early life at any rate, and knew it was the wrong choice. But I felt like I had to experience part of that. I had to have something was there that drew me to it. But it kind of flowed through this to me that what it came into the end is it may be trite, but it's not so much saying have a happy day at the end, but maybe it's the screwing up and the good actions that both have to come together in order to actually make this place a beautiful place. And then the other comment is that the answer, I heard two poets do a discussion, John O'Donohue and I can't remember her name at the time, at this point, but the comment they made is poetry's job is never to give you an answer. It's simply to raise a question, and it's your job to find the answer. That's good art.
So, thank you. Thank you very much.
This one struck me really personally because I felt like he kind of makes you think about, oh, the world is out there, you know, doing some of these things, but it's really me. Mm-hmm. I'm the terrible 50% of the time or more conservative estimate. You know, I've thrown the stones at the birds, even though I love the birds. And I'm the one who's bagged and drowned my children at times. And I know that hard work, really, really hard work, can make a place beautiful, even if it starts out a shithole. So I think I have hope, but I think I really have a strong dose of reality as well.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
I guess I saw growth through life in this poem. I mean, you have kids, and you know, you have the baby, and you have the baby in your arms, and you're not going to say you're going to die. You know, I mean, you put positive, try to put positive thoughts in their brains so that, you know, they can. Have a positive experience as they experience the world. And it's making you trying to be the safe place. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I think Bill said what he said. I agree with. He said, life is short. And then it jumps all the way to the fairly final words, you could make this place beautiful. I think that we in our own world can do what we can, and the very little that we can, to make the surroundings around us beautiful. So I think it comes down to that.
Thank you. And then Brian, and then I have a finishing.
Really, everyone who talked said such great things. Karen, I relate to what she said completely. But I was thinking through first half of it, or the first most of it. Those are all things that I struggle with my faith, you know. And if somebody has a question about those things, how can you believe a God that would let this happen? All the questions I have for God, those are all things that are hard for me and keep faith difficult for me. But then I think this last stanza, this place could be beautiful. You could make this place beautiful. And so it just brings it back, I think, to what could I do to make things beautiful. And as far as hiding things from our children, yeah, thank God we have. I guess.
Jeff, you have such a rushed gait. There's a book called Good Omens by Neil Gaiman. And one of the characters in it, his name is Adam. He's an 11-year-old boy. And Adam is the Antichrist. But babies were swapped in the hospital, and Adam grew up without the influence he was supposed to have. And he grew up loving his neighborhood and three other 11-year-olds. And yeah, they were a gang of hellions that rode their bicycles and were always getting in trouble. But it comes to the end, and Adam says that I love what is and the possibilities, and life is too short. If it was up to me, I'd let everyone live to be 100, and maybe we could get it right.
Thank you for all of those thoughts. I'm just going to do this real quick. I really want a cool name. But I was trying to think of a way we read, and I've just come up with kingdom reading, that way we as people living in overlapping ages read, and how, you know, I say reading itself is a creative act. You read this way, I read that way. And I relate so much to what Dan said, to being in school and being told this is how you read this. Well, really, for me, the poem is all of these things, these constellations of ideas, and every time I read this, I will hold those. And that is the reading, is all of these experiences and ideas that I now share with you, some having more weight than others. And kingdom reading is not a proposal. It's like an idea of how we read, that we're building through this. And it's rooted in a theology of new creation. You can read other ways, but this is what I am suggesting. When we read a poem that perhaps laments the age of death, or maybe prophesies against the age of death, or you know, convicts the age of death, I think, you know, that's a kingdom reading. This, once again, is something Ty sent me. I liked a lot, from Salman Rushdie. A poem cannot stop a bullet. A novel can't defuse a bomb. But we are not helpless. We can sing the truth and name the liars. Perhaps more on a different way, it can make a kingdom reading is when we read a poem and we consider alternatives to the age of death, maybe even proclaiming the coming of the return of Christ. N.T. Wright says that a Jewish person in first century Palestine would have still considered themselves living in exile. The geographical exile was over, but the theological exile continued because the Jewish people had been an occupied people more or less since Babylon. He says, our task, the church's task, is to announce in deed and word that the exile is over, to enact the symbols that speak of healing and forgiveness, to act boldly in God's world in the power of the Spirit. Anyway, so...